The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
He told me a story about the tobacco industry donating a lot of money to his particular university, but a condition of it being that that university would store a bunch of documents years ago down in their basement or somewhere and forget about them.
David Fonville shares the inside story on the missing documents that helped turn Florida's lawsuit against the big tobacco companies into a racketeering case, and the case early in his career that impacted his practice for life.
It's helped me in every case I've ever had, because what I learned from it the best was listening to the client. You can't be predisposed by what others tell you, others think. If I'd have been predisposed by the tobacco case, I'd have never taken it.
And how he defends running his law firm as a business enterprise.
I had many, many lawyers say, you're treating it like a business. And I think it's important for everyone to realize it is a business. The law profession is a business, and if you don't run it like a business and a successful business, then you're not going to be in business.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I am Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. David Fonville went from running a concessions business on Fort Lauderdale Beach to eventually starting a personal injury law firm in Tallahassee. He gladly shares how he did it and why, including overcoming concern about advertising, to become the first firm in the region to actively mass market. His work on Florida's lawsuit against Big Tobacco was but one of several cases that forced changes in consumer products, sparing injuries and saving lives. He took on the world's largest manufacturer of space heaters, forcing a complete product recall and redesign. David Fonville, still growing strong at age 75, sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in January 2020 to talk about his humble beginnings, how he learned to outwork and outsmart the other side, and why he thinks this is a great time to be practicing law as a personal injury lawyer.
David, your most famous case was the big Florida tobacco case. You were a member of the so-called Dream Team, nine Florida lawyers who took on the big tobacco companies in the mid-1990s on behalf of the state of Florida, seeking to recoup Medicaid money spent on the care of ailing smokers. The team won a record $13-plus billion settlement from Big Tobacco, along with a series of marketplace reforms. But that was a tough choice for you to even join the team, wasn't it?
It was, and it wasn't. I think one of the strengths that I developed during my career, and by that time, was the ability to look at a case and look at it all the way down the line. And I remember the call very well. Fred Levin called me and told me about the case. I really knew nothing about it at the time, and invited me to join. I asked him if I could think about it and talk about it with my partners, and he said, of course. And I thought about it a while, and the first thing that occurred to me, and I remember it well, is that this is a good cause. This is the right thing to do. I was accustomed to chasing big corporations who tried to defeat us, usually with the delay tactics, with overwhelming us, not with the facts. So actually, my initial thoughts on the case were that I would want to do it. The secondary thoughts that came to my mind immediately, and to my partners was that we figured it would take at least 5 years, if not more, to handle the case. We figured that I wouldn't be totally unproductive during that time. We assumed we would be spending a huge amount of money on costs. I thought we'd win. As pompous as that may sound, I thought we'd win from the beginning. I thought we had justice and right on our side.
And you had mass tort experience at that point in your career, too.
Yes, I had done a lot of mass tort experience. I was very, very accustomed to mass tort, and I was very accustomed to dealing with obstinate corporations and lots of lawyers that didn't want to be nice and wanted to do everything they could to obstruct what we were doing. That much I could see right through. So the decision was easy as to whether or not I thought it was a winner, whether or not I wanted to do it. Both of those were yes, it was a winner, yes, I wanted to do it. We frankly did not, our opinion here in the firm was that we would not get paid in our lifetimes. And you may have heard this from other members, but it was a consensus on the team that we were doing this for our children, not for us, but we were doing it for America, because it was time that somebody got the truth out of the tobacco company.
And your legal fellow legal team member, W.C. Gentry of Jacksonville, noted in his Titans of Trial podcast interview that you played, David, a little-known but very important role, essentially doing all of the depositions in that case.
Well, yes, I did all of the depositions because I was in charge of all of the plaintiff's discovery. I handled all the interrogatories, I handled the depositions, I handled all the production of evidence in response to the tobacco industry's requests for production and documents. And the tobacco industry, actually in the very beginning of the case, I mean, within the first couple of months, their lawyers, so to speak, sat me down, as they tended to want to do, and told me that they were going to absolutely ruin the case and us with the amount of discovery that they were going to force us to produce. And in this case, it was going to be me, because I was in charge of producing it all. It all had to come from the state of Florida. I'm in Tallahassee. And that it was going to be more documents than we could produce in our lifetime. And that was just one of the ways they were going to delay this trial until we all were gone.
And there was a lot more of them than there were you guys. You were a team of 11. There were a couple out-of-state attorneys, so it was essentially 11 key principals pushing the case. But you had, what, 120, 130 tobacco lawyers against you?
Yes. They didn't do anything without a team. I mean, if I went to a hearing down in Palm Beach in court, it'd be me or me and one other team member, perhaps. And it would be, there'd be more lawyers than would from the tobacco industry that could fit at the table, and there'd be more in the audience.
Intimidating?
Not really. It never occurred to me that it was intimidating.
Well, there's a story about you interrupting a deposition once to call a judge. Tell us about that.
Part of the tactic of the defense was to delay this case forever, because that meant it cost us, being the plaintiff's lawyers, more money. It was obvious that we had no time to generate money for our law firms. So any time that anything happened, whether it's a deposition or any other hearing, even if there was a way to delay it, the tobacco industry would come up with it. And one of their ways that they would delay things in depositions would be to raise issues which required a hearing. And being the plaintiff's lawyers, objected to an issue, then they would instruct their witness not to answer it until we got an order from a judge. Whether they were right or wrong, they knew that in theory it takes months to get a hearing. You know, we'd ask the question, they'd object, they'd tell the witness not to answer it, they'd look at us and say, what are you going to do now? And they did this for a while, and we got sucked into it, so to speak, and we'd have hearings, and we'd wait weeks or a long time to get a hearing, only for the judge to say go back to the deposition. So I finally decided, and with the team backing me on the decisions, that we're going to quit tolerating delays one way or another. In the production of evidence, we just produced it all. And in the depositions, and this being an example, when the defense lawyers, and there was, I don't even remember, probably five of them here in this room that we're in right now, objected and instructed the witness not to answer, and they said, we'll come. They were starting to, actually, they stood up and started packing their bags, and I said, no, y'all sit down. I didn't tell them what I was going to do. And I excused myself, told them to wait, went out, and I called the judge's office down in Palm Beach. Got a hold of his secretary, his paralegal, told her what was going on, told her I'd like to have a phone hearing right now on the motion. Wow. So that we could keep this going. The judge, fortunately, was receptive to it. He came on the phone and said, get the other side. I didn't tell him what it was about, other than we had a discovery issue. I came back into the room. The lawyers were here, put a speakerphone in the middle of the table, got the judge on the phone, introduced him to the defense lawyers, and we had a hearing right there. And 15 minutes later, I had an order from the judge, and the judge instructed the lawyers to stay put and for their witness to answer the question. And we went forward from there. And I don't think we ever had that happen again in the whole case. That was it.
Good for you. Yeah. The Big Tobacco case at the time, that was the largest ever brought in the world, litigation-wise, document-wise, witness-wise, damages-wise, at $13-plus billion. Largest recovery in the history of jurisprudence, at least at that time, maybe today still even. David, how did that case change you or impact you?
It's never really occurred to me that it did. My whole career, I don't think there was ever a period of time, a period being a five-year period, that I wasn't litigating against a big corporation that would throw everything at us that they had, including always, you know, four or five lawyers. I don't want to say it was just another case, but as Bob Montgomery said throughout the case, it's just more zeros. That's all it is. When we'd get uptight about the case, sometimes down in Palm Beach, Bob would just sit everyone down and say, guys, it's just another case with more zeros. And I hope the case didn't change me. I can't imagine that it did, because I feel like I certainly had other cases that were as meaningful in my career.
Well, now that case turned from a products case into a fraud case, into a criminal case, and really in the end, a racketeering case. Your deposition work, did that bear that out?
The discovery documents from plaintiff and defendant, everything that I went through from the state to give to the defense, everything that I went through from the defense in response to our interrogatories, really what that did was confirm what we all, being the tobacco team, believed to be the facts anyway, that we were dealing with subversive, unethical, and untruthful corporation that had snookered America for decades. I think one of the many things, several things that moved us forward more on the RICO, on the racketeering, was as the case went on and we got publicity throughout America on our case. This phone call actually came to me one day. My cell phone rang. I didn't recognize the number, and I was able to step out, answered it, and it was a professor in a university in California. And he'd read my name or seen my name on TV and related to this case, and somehow had been able to track me down for some reason. And he told me a story about the tobacco industry donating a lot of money to his particular university, but a condition of it being that that university would store a bunch of documents years ago down in their basement or somewhere and forget about them. And he said that he thought we should come out there and look at them. And I was in court at the time, and I did the next thing, best thing I could come up with is I called Ron Motley, who was just a great part of the team. He's since passed away. And he was in trial in Texas. So he walks out of the trial and talks to me, and I tell him what's going on. And Ron's words were, "I'm on it." And Ron had an airplane out there in California within hours. They recovered the boxes, and we got documents that the tobacco industry had been saying didn't exist for decades. And at that point, if ever there was a RICO case, we had it. And that's not the only reason we went with RICO. The appellate process that was going on the statutory issues had a lot to do with it. But
sure.
That sure solidified our direction.
Let's go back to the beginning. What made you want to be a lawyer?
It's interesting because I didn't really want to be a lawyer. What I thought, what I believed I wanted, and I was correct in it, I'm sure, is I wanted the legal education for business. I owned a business in my first career for about 5 years down in Fort Lauderdale. I owned the beach concession on Broward County Beach. And it's actually a busy business, a lot of little products. And I met a lot of people there, very successful people, Fort Lauderdale Beach, CEOs and lawyers, and the thing that was in common between them all is they had a legal education. And one of the lawyers that I got to know very well told me he thought I'd make a good lawyer, and he said, read Louis Neiser's books. And you probably don't even know who Louis Neiser is or was.
Nope.
Or was. He was one of the original lawyers that went after the big corporations. You're talking back in the 50s and 60s. He started coming down on the corruption within the corporate world. And I read his books and I said, this really looks like something I'd like. And I decided to go, I'd graduate from undergrad, and I decided that I'd go to law school to get the education and then to decide what to do with it. I was as interested in using it for business as I was to be a lawyer. I didn't know which way I was going to go at that time.
Now, you grew up in Fort Lauderdale. You attended University of Florida undergraduate. Then you came to Tallahassee for law school at Florida State University. You ended up joining the public defender's office out of law school, right?
Yes.
How did that happen?
I got married about halfway through law school, and that kind of changed my perspective on things because when I graduated, I needed a job to help support my wife and I. She was a teacher, and seemed to me with a law degree, the easiest way to make an instant salary was as a lawyer. And I ran into a classmate named Wayne Hogan.
Turned out later one of your tobacco dream team lawyers, right?
We were
Jacksonville.
We graduated together, and he said, "Hey, I had a job with the public defender's office, but I'm going to go do some military time. Why don't you come take my job?" And I didn't even take criminal procedure. I emphasized tax in law school because I wanted to be ready to go into business. So it was the only offer out there, and I took it. Public defender.
You have a client story from that time that has stayed with you to today, hasn't it?
Correct.
Tell us about that.
It stayed with me because it's really had an impact on my law practice. And a client came in, public defender. As a public defender, we have the indigent clients. This guy gets handed over to me and by the court to represent, and he's charged with armed robbery. And it's one of these things, it's a daylight armed robbery inside a bank, and there's eyewitnesses to the whole thing. And they arrest my guy two blocks away. This is in the early 70s, and I remember it like yesterday. They arrest him two blocks away, and when the police try to stop him, of course, he takes off running later to testify, just because they were police. That's why I was running. And he jumps in a car to try to get away, but of course they catch him. They bring him back, they put him in a lineup, and everyone identifies him as the guy. And I meet him, and he's very solemn, but he says, "I didn't do it." And I spent a lot of time getting to know him. I spent a lot of time listening to him. I've been a lot of time getting to understand where he was coming from and that he was believable. And he taught me that I needed to listen to him, because he had a story about why he didn't do it, and a reason, which was that he didn't do it, but he could explain it. And I took the time to listen, and the state came with plea bargains and plea offers, and he wouldn't take them, and he forced me to go to trial in a case where I had big questions. I didn't think I could win it. I just had too many eyewitnesses. We went to trial, and the jury was out maybe, I don't remember exactly, but 30 minutes or less, and they came back not guilty. And some of the jurors came up to me afterwards and thanked me for representing the guy. And this is a black guy in the early 70s with half the jury white, half the jury black.
Sure, sure.
Probably. And they're saying, we could tell you believed in him, and it helped us. He said, we believed him. And
wow,
that story stuck with me, and it's helped me in every case I've ever had, because what I learned from it the best was listening to the client. You can't be predisposed by what others tell you, others think. If I'd have been predisposed by the tobacco case, I'd have never taken it. They'd never lost a case. But you have to be able to look through it, look to the end.
And that seems to have been a theme in your legal career to date, because after you left the public defender's office, you eventually, in rather short order, ended up in personal injury law. One of the cases that you're best known for, as well, as a product liability case, the DeLonghi heater case. Tell us about that one.
Okay. One of my guidelines when I went into private practice and left the public defender's office, it was a personal guideline, was that I would always have a pro bono case going in my office of my own, not legal aid, of my own. So every year or two, I would take on, by my choice, what case, some case, whether it was a criminal case or a civil case, being a personal injury case, and I would do it for free. And somewhere along the line, we're talking 15 years plus after I'd started my private practice, I had finished up a case the prior year, and I was in the market, so to speak, for my next pro bono case. And a lady came in from a small surrounding county, Wakulla County, to see me because her house had burned down. And she told me that it burned down when she was sitting in her living room. It was actually a mobile home. And she was sitting there on a cold day with a DeLonghi space heater facing her. And as she was sitting in there, the heater suddenly caught on fire. And she, in order to save herself, she ran outside, but she went outside and got a hose and was trying to squirt it out, but she couldn't, and it burned her trailer down. It was an older mobile home. And she told me, if you'll represent me on this, I'll give you whatever I can. I don't have any money, but it's a contingent fee type thing. You tell me how much you want.
I mean, there's no injury, but she's out a $1,000, $1,500 value.
Yep. There was no one was hurt.
Right.
The only damage was her trailer burned to the ground, which I figured out pretty quick was worth $1,000 or $1,200. And all of her belongings, which might have been 200 or 300. It was a very poor lady in a dilapidated, rundown mobile home.
Sure.
So I took the case thinking, this is, quotes, easy. We've got a lady looking at the heater. She can describe the fire. And it burned her house down, and all she wants is $1,200 for the home and a couple hundred dollars for her belongings. And if DeLonghi really wants to litigate over that, they're crazy. So I got a hold of DeLonghi eventually. I mean, after tracking him down to DeLonghi America, I had an office up in Albany, New York. And I talked to him, and their answer was not only no, but forget it. Said, we have never lost one of these cases. Our heaters don't catch on fire. And if you want to sue us, you sue us, but you're not going to win. You need to go look at the history of our cases, which I did. And it seemed like they never lost a case. He was right. But I had a witness, being the plaintiff, who saw the heater catch on fire. And it seemed like, to me, actually a pretty easy case. So I filed suit, thinking that'll bring them to their senses. They're not going to litigate over $1,500 case.
Sure.
I filed suit in Wakulla County in state court, and I kept them in state court. And they immediately sent their New York lawyers down here with their team, which wasn't a tobacco team, but there was three or four of them. And they again told me that they never lost a case and they weren't going to lose this one. And it turned out that we actually had to litigate this case. It went on, pretty sure it went on 7 years. But what happened during discovery in the case, one of the things we decided to do, I decided to help prove my causation, meaning that it was the heater that caught on fire, was I published a nationwide ad, and it basically I offered a reward for burned or fire damaged DeLonghi heaters, and my reward was $5 more than the cost of the heater new.
Mm.
And we had a tremendous, surprising response to this, and we actually ended up flying all over the country and meeting people at airports and buying their fire damaged heaters from them, and we ended up with several hundred fire damaged DeLonghi heaters.
Wow.
But along the way, we ended up with 5 death cases where people not only came to the airport to meet with us and bring us a heater, but to tell us about their relative or loved one who had died in the fire and ask us if we would take the case because they hadn't been able to find anybody to take the case. And we ended up with 5 death cases around the country on the basis of these heaters catching on fire. And the long story short is, after about 7 years, DeLonghi had paid us millions of dollars on the death cases. I had kept the property damage case going here in Florida because we were in federal court all around the country, and I needed a friendly judge. So when we would have discovery issues, I'd come back to Florida. And the last case to settle was the lady here in Florida. And I don't remember if it was a confidential settlement, so I'm not going to say the amount, but it was in a great multiples of the amount of money that she lost. And I, because it was my rule on my pro bono cases, I gave it all to her. So,
wow. And that's a case that probably no one else would have taken. Or would not have gone to the length that you did, but my goodness, what a treasure trove it unearthed.
It did. It was surprising. And in that's also one of my, in my opinion, one of my greater victories, because DeLonghi Heaters is the largest space heater manufacturer in the world, and we forced a complete redesign of that heater and a recall of it all over the world. So
that's got to be a proud moment for you.
Very proud.
And especially those death cases where those people lost loved ones and no one would take the case.
Not only wouldn't they take the case, but in most of those cases of death cases, I ended up going to the states where the people hired us and going to the lawyers that they'd gone in to meet with who had rejected the case, and the lawyers had to dig the files out and give me their rejection files with all the documents in it they'd accumulated before they rejected the case. Mm.
David, along the way from transitioning from the public defender's office to private personal injury practice, you started your own law firm, Soul Law Firm, and as a matter of fact, you're considered to be the first lawyer here in the greater Tallahassee area to start a law firm and run it like a business. How did you do it?
Well, I came from running a business before I went to law school. So when I went to open a law firm, that was my frame of reference. And instead of starting a business by spending a lot of money, which it seemed like so many people did, especially law practices, I started a business as inexpensively as I could, but with as high a profile as I could at the same time. I got an office down in the middle of town, in the middle of all the lawyers. I had the smallest, least decorated office that anyone had seen down there, but I had an office. I had a part-time paralegal. I went around and I met all the lawyers in Tallahassee. I introduced myself. By that time, most of them knew who I was simply because of a lot of the criminal trials I'd tried. And it helps certainly to start a business if people know who you are. So I got in the door everywhere, introduced myself. I told them what I was doing. I told them I'd do anything. And the business started coming in. I continued for 10 years to do nothing but invest myself in my business. My wife and I lived as inexpensively as we could. We bought a home and paid $16,000 for it and financed it. We didn't take any vacations for 10 years. All the money stayed with the firm because the killers in starting up personal injury firms is overhead, is the concern about the outflow of money in a business that's very risky. So I'm saying I want to be a personal injury lawyer, and I'm going to take cases on contingent fees, and I'm going to have obviously good years and bad, because if you lose every case, you're really out of business. And if you've got to win some, but you can't be in the office worrying about money. So my philosophy was pay everything off as far as I could and keep my overhead to a minimum, so that when I was working on a case, I didn't have to worry about what bills I had to pay, because I virtually had no bills. In that first 10 years, we even paid off our house. We didn't owe money on cars. We didn't owe money on houses. We didn't owe money on an office. My overhead was still minimally low. I was renting. My equipment was minimal. I did have a full-time paralegal, but I did a lot of the paralegal work. I did all the investigation work myself. I didn't go out and front the money for an investigator only to find out the case wasn't good and I wasted the money. I did it.
And that was something you learned earlier in your career.
In the public defender's office, yeah. We had to do our own investigation. Mm-hmm. They just didn't have the resources to have investigators. So I felt I knew what I was doing there. But from starting the business, within 5 years, I had my business going. It wasn't making a huge amount of money, but it didn't matter because I had no debt, no overhead. And I treated that business just like I did in Fort Lauderdale on the beach. I had overhead, I had costs, everything was devoted to that first. If there was any profit, it went to help us at home. My wife kept teaching school. She did quit after about 5 years, but we were very conservative until the thing really got rolling. And I looked at it, I had many, many lawyers say, you're treating it like a business. And I think it's important for everyone to realize it is a business. And if you as a personal injury lawyer are in the office and you're worried about how you're going to pay your bills, or you're worried about how you're going to afford that new car, or you're worried about how you can afford your house, you're not serving your client. And that's how I always looked at it. I always said it's not fair to these people that are relying on me to compensate for their injuries, not go to jail, whatever it was, for me to be worried about something else. And that's what drove me.
And you've built that sole proprietorship legal firm into a multi-member, nationally known, giant regional up here in North Florida, personal injury firm with many lawyers and associates. Now, you said you can't do that if you lose too many cases. And you do, David, have an amazing track record of trial success. What would you say is the key to that? Is there one skill?
I think I have a great ability to interview somebody, a client, learn all about them. It comes from listening, paying attention, and understand, get an initial understanding of their cause of action, so to speak, their case, and look all the way down the road on it and be realistic, whether it's the amount of cost or the amount of risk. And I have been very good at taking cases that I should take and rejecting the cases that we shouldn't take. That has a lot to do with it. The other part of it is, just because you take a case and you think it's good, then the work ethic comes in and the ethics of working come in, so to speak, the ethics of being a lawyer. And I structured my life, although around my family, my hours, which continued until the last, till probably 8 years ago, my hours were, you got here early. I always had an exercise routine. Early in the morning, I'd run or work out. But I'm in the office by 7:30, home for dinner with the wife and kids. When the kids went to bed, back to the office. Because in the daytime, you could hardly ever get serious work done because of all interruptions. So in this office, for years, the nights were active here. They were work time. And then Saturday, we usually took off with the kids. Sunday after church, you were back to the office and it was a regular day. So the success came from hard work. It comes first from evaluating the case, but that doesn't mean it's a winner. It just means you can win it if you work hard enough. And then working hard enough and being smart enough, outworking and outsmarting the other side, and here you are.
Boy, that seems to be a common theme among the titans of trial that we've interviewed. And what an amazing career. Many, many accolades, super lawyers listed, best lawyers in America, frequently on the Florida Trends listed legal elites. You have served on the board of directors of the Florida Justice Association. You've been an Eagle sponsor. How has your involvement with the FJA impacted your career?
Well, the FJA was the AFTL when I started, the academy. And when I went into private practice and then started focusing on personal injury law, I started looking around for who the great lawyers were, the great personal injury lawyers. I'm a firm believer in continuing education. I've always loved going to seminars and ultimately speaking at the seminars and teaching in the law schools. But I started looking at who the great guys were out there. And this is back in the 70s. And, you know, the names Al Cohn and Perry Nichols and Fred Levin and Shelley Schlesinger, who I worked with on the tobacco case. Yeah. And Bob Montgomery, these names came up, but they were all part of the academy. And so I had gone to seminars and heard these guys, and actually gone and watched some of them in the courtroom. Fred Levin, I'd watched, and Shelley Schlesinger. And I joined the academy so I could be around them. And I started going to the academy meetings anytime I could. I got involved in that I would volunteer for whatever could be done in Tallahassee. I ended up getting to know all these lawyers around the state that were part of the academy, and then ultimately the FJA. I got on the board and was on there quite a few years, I don't remember how many, and was there to help, and I helped every way I could. I lobbied 1 year when we needed another lobbyist up there in the legislature. And I have to say that very honestly, I've made my best friends in the law practice, in the academy, and in the Florida Justice Association. They're still my best friends. I learned more from them about trying a case than from anybody, with one exception, a certain judge. But these guys taught me, I hate to say it this way, but I learned everything I know, whatever that is, from somebody in the Florida Justice Association back over the years. I can remember specifically going to some of these academy meetings and FJA meetings and hearing somebody say, some great trial lawyer in my opinion say, I just tried a case and I did this. And coming back here because I had a similar case and doing exactly that and trying it out. Yeah. And winning because of it. I've just found it to be a jewel.
The folks you named, they had to have been great mentors along the way.
Oh, yeah.
What is your view on the legal profession today? Because we're seeing your example manyfold on and the complaint that it has become, the law profession has become too much like a business. Do you subscribe to that? Do you have concerns?
Truthfully, I do not. The law profession is a business, and if you don't run it like a business and a successful business, then you're not going to be in business. So I don't have any problem with advertising anymore. I mean, I did initially, but I get it now. It's part of business. I don't have any problem with the new lawyers. I think there are as many bright new lawyers coming up as I've ever seen. I think the political climate is certainly could be considered, let's kill all the lawyers, but I was hearing that in 1979, so it's no different. I'm excited about the current time in history for the law profession, and quite frankly, have told my partners and many others that I wish I was about 25 or 30 years younger. Because I think this is a great, great time to be practicing law as a personal injury lawyer, and I would love to be trying more cases now.
David, how would you like to be remembered?
It's real simple to me. As a great husband and the best father. Period.
David Fonville, you are a titan of trial. Thank you, sir.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.